I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Debbie Irving is a white woman born into privilege who, as middle age approached, embarked on a personal journey to understand race and racism. She'll tell us what she learned about herself and about American society as we take this hour of Midday for another discussion about how race and racism affect our lives in ways visible and invisible. Up front, we hear from Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities of Maryland, and the Reverend Douglas Miles, Bishop of Koinonia Baptist Church in Baltimore. They signed their names to newspaper ads calling for honest discussion, economic opportunities, and policy changes to end the structural racism they see at the root of the city's problems. A talk about race and racism, structural and personal, on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Midday on the Bay in the second hour today, Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal for our monthly report on news environmental. Today, a look at efforts to get more green space in the redevelopment plans for Towson. New practices to control polluting runoff from Eastern Shore Farms. And Rona tells us about a trip she just took with other eco-journalists to areas of the Chesapeake Bay from Baltimore down to Blackwater, threatened by natural phenomena and human behavior. All that coming up in the second hour of our show today. Could you be a racist without knowing it, even if you consider yourself to be colorblind, a well-intentioned white person who would never utter a bigoted word or harbor a prejudiced thought? Debbie Irving explored such questions during a personal journey of discovery about race, racism, and white privilege that she chronicled in a book called Waking Up White. We'll speak with Debbie Irving during the second half of this hour on racism. Up front, we welcome two guests to Studio A who are leaders in Baltimore. For nearly 4 years, they've been meeting as part of a work group on racial equality issues in the city, sponsored in part by the Aspen Institute, Associated Black Charities of Maryland, the Baltimore Community Foundation, and the Open Society Institute. The Reverend Douglas Miles is with us, Bishop of Koinonia Baptist Church in Baltimore, and co-chair emeritus of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD, the grassroots organization that's been very hard at work here in Baltimore City for two or three decades now. Nice to have you back. 35 years. Nice to have you back on the show with us, Bishop Miles.
Good to be with you.
And Diane Bell McCoy is here today, president and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Nice to have you on the show with us, too, Diane.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So what prompted this discussion was an advertisement that appeared in the Baltimore Sun, Afro-American, quarter-page ad, or more than a half-page ad, that says, "The time is now for real, inclusive, and transformative change," an ad that calls for conversations, changes in public policy, efforts to include more people in economic expansion as a way of dealing with structural racism. I guess you could say in our show today, in this half hour, it's structural racism. We'll talk about personal racism in the second half of this hour. So what brought this about? I mentioned the Aspen Institute. The Aspen Institute has actually been sponsoring these conversations in Baltimore. So tell us a little bit about the background first, please, Diane.
The Aspen Institute actually started looking at this issue of dismantling structural racism across the country out of the community initiative at the Aspen Institute. They had done some research and had seen that a number of communities where you had a number of people of color, the inequality was still there, disparities were still there. And so they got funding, and they began with bringing community foundation leaders from across the country to Aspen, Colorado for training, very deep, intensive training. I actually got to attend towards the end of a 2 year set of this training was going on. Mm-hmm. And we came back, a number of people went through it in Baltimore, and we began to talk about, what do we do with this? How do we take this and do something with it? And we decided we really need to expand the circle of people that understood this and could go deeper. And so we actually pulled our resources at the time we began with OSI, Baltimore Community Foundation, ABC, and we looked at a number of other leaders, corporate, philanthropic, faith, civic, who we wanted to invite to go deeper in this conversation. And we did a retreat at Aspen White River. That began the Aspen-Baltimore group.
And that group has been in place
now for the last 4 or 5 years.
Just 4 or 5 years. We've been in
place. And we've expanded to include others and taken them to some of the similar training.
So let me ask you this. It's 2015. What is structural racism in 2015? Bishop Miles, you want to take that?
It's all of the policies and strategies that have been in place in America since its existence that has denied access to black people in particular and minorities in a general sense, women, that prevents people from sharing equitably in the resources and the upward mobility that this society has to offer.
Someone might hear that now and say, what do you mean? We did away with segregation. We did away with Jim Crow laws. We've had lots of court rulings in favor of equality and diversity in our culture.
We often develop public policy in this country based on the premise of universality, that when we develop that policy, it's going to benefit everybody equally. That's not true. And so the clear implication of that is you end up with people who disproportionately don't benefit. Very recently, if you look at our housing policies in this country. So that's both historical as well as current. So that we also say that you want to look at and prevent structural racism from continuing to grow inside of policy. So you have to ask questions and begin to recognize that what you may believe from where you sit in terms of universality may not be true mm-hmm. for other people.
It's very challenging.
It's very challenging.
Well, and housing, to be specific about that, we can look at the subprime period here, subprime mess, if you want to call it, and we'll see minorities who in Baltimore City were eager to buy homes were steered into the subprime arena for financing.
Very definitely, and I think the policies are more insidious than that and more evasive for people to see on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. That's why so many in the Baltimore region were caught off guard by what happened back in April. When you build a road system that brings people from the suburbs to downtown without them ever interacting with the communities that lie between the suburbs and downtown, then they tend to think everything's fine. If you get on 83 and drive 83 from the suburbs downtown, then you never see lower Park Heights, you never see Greenmount, you never see the devastation that's a part of this city and that has been festering and growing for the past 40 years.
I would also add that what structural racism does that you don't get a chance to see is that we also begin to think that it only impacts low income or poor people, poor black people. That's not true. You just describe in terms of, and Bishop Miles will talk about this in terms of housing, that you can be African American, Latino, and still have impacted by structural racism as middle class. There are lots of times in terms of the whole issue of what the outcomes are for employment. In terms of if you're white with education and you're black with education, it's absolutely factual that somebody white with education, same education, is going to make more money, greater opportunity. So we've got to be clear that this is structural policies that are in place that allow access and opportunity greater for one body of persons than another.
Yeah, I find it interesting that Bishop Miles mentioned highway. And when I got to Baltimore in the 70s, I was looking very carefully at that. Over the years, I've been fascinated by the highway system through Baltimore that ultimately was stopped from being completed. But the big parts that did occur involved lots of demolition. Mm-hmm. Demolition over there in the Franklin-Mulberry corridor of block after block of homes inhabited mostly by African-American mm-hmm. families.
Middle-class African-American.
And middle-class, too. Mm-hmm. That was one part. So that's and that became known as the highway to nowhere. I mean, that's literally structural racism, I guess you could call it that, because it abetted white flight from the city as well. It made the suburbs possible.
Very definitely.
It made what you're talking about mm-hmm. Possible. And then there's the 83 corridor, right? I don't know that we have a look at that framed in this way, but this is interesting. So what do you do with this conversation, though? I guess that's the next part of it. You identify structural racism. And maybe a lot of people would agree with you. A lot of people would say, may dispute it. But anyway, going on from there, what do you do?
Well, first of all, understanding what structural racism is, because it is so nuanced and it is so complicated. It is so important that we educate. And that's not a one time and you're done conversation. Most people think, lots of us in part of the Baltimore Aspen group, continue to grow deeper our level of understanding where it exists. The goal of that is so that where we sit, in our corporate space, where we sit in our nonprofit, where we sit on boards, that we can begin to be a part of dismantling it. But it's not a quick fix. And it's not a quick, now that you know this, because you don't know it all at once. And I will tell you, there were a number of people that participated in the Aspen Y River that were very, very educated, will tell you they knew all about structural racism. They were shocked. They were shocked about
it. What were they shocked by? I was just going to ask you what these discussions were like.
One, I remember, I believe Bishop, was around the housing one, in terms of going back historically and talking about the development of post-World War II and the availability of funding in communities that were created to be all white. The whole huge development of housing tracts that happened for these returning veterans to have a house. And they actually created them and said, this will be all white. And in many cases, African Americans who were veterans could not benefit from that. That really began the middle class for this country. And so that's a very clear, people were surprised. And I think when you use tools like video and other things to educate people, take them out of the space, they go, oh, wow, I didn't know that existed.
So you take that bit of history and then you understand a little better about how people became separated. Right. How we became segregated. It wasn't just laws, it was also policy. Right?
Very definitely. Policy more so than laws.
Yeah.
And I think what's important about this whole discussion is that this is the first time in my memory that persons in the corporate community have admitted there's a race problem in Baltimore.
In these work groups, you mean?
Yes. And in reality, race governs just about every major decision that's made in this city. In regards to policy, in regards to where investments go, in regards to education and every other major institution that you can look at, race drives the decision making.
What was the racial makeup of this the Aspen Baltimore work group? What would you say?
I think the group was probably about 50-50.
About 50-50.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's about 50-50.
And did you have any skeptics in there? I mean, did anyone
Absolutely.
Come to this group saying, wait a minute, structural racism? What do you say? What do you mean it's nuanced? I thought we broke all this apart with laws over the years.
Absolutely. There were a number of people. The staff person from Aspen Gretchen does a pre-conversation with all the participants before both retreats to get a sense of what do they know already. And people after the training, after the session, after the interaction of understanding what it was, realize how much they didn't know. But I would add, after the incident in April for Baltimore, number of people where there are shows that were done on NPR that began to talk about these policies. I will tell you, people then, particularly people, African Americans as well as whites, said, I didn't know that. I didn't know that's how the problem got started. And so I want to be clear about the ad campaign in terms of encouraging this kind of conversation, sending people to lots of resources that are already going on in the city. This isn't the it. This isn't the it. We were just trying to stimulate the conversation, drive more people to explore it, to go deeper, because we need an army of people that understand structural racism and are part of the change process. And there are lots of folks on the ground, Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, Bill, there are lots of organizations that are doing different things, pushing the same direction, but pushing differently. So we're not the it, and we want to be clear about that. We wanted to use this opportunity to lift the conversation up on top of the table.
Gretchen you refer to, Gretchen Susi,
yes,
director of the Aspen Institute Roundtable on Community Change. She coordinated all
She's
this
for
you.
She's a staff person for this,
I guess.
With us. Yes.
Well, what would you say about this then? We've made a couple of references to the riot on April 27th, the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. What would you say that episode in Baltimore's life revealed about 2015 structural racism? What could you say about that?
I think it revealed to a new generation of corporate leaders that Baltimore was not and is not the city they thought it was. I think it revealed to us, particularly to corporate Baltimore, that it has a stake in changing the city, because after $20 billion of investment, they just can't up and move it. And this whole situation reveals some nasty things about Baltimore that are keeping people away now and driving people away. So, again, I think that helps to spur the discussion, and not just the discussion, but hopefully where action will match rhetoric, and that people will begin to act differently in this city and to act in a way that's more inclusive, that seeks to remedy some of the ills that have festered for 30 years, 30 to 40 years in this city, so that Baltimore can be the city that it's meant to be.
I would add that it also, in addition to what Bishop Miles has shared, that it also revealed that people and many of the communities where we would refer to this uprising versus riots, that people are not broken. We have this perception that people in low-income communities of color are broken. And the reality is systems and policies broke them. And so you cannot live in a community that has limited resources, a community that, as you look around you in terms of the vacancy, you look around you in terms of all the challenges that those systems, you look around you, interaction with the police, who may not know the good guy from the bad guy. You cannot live in that environment and not have to adjust for your own survival. But we want to treat people as though they are broken. They're not broken. They are very much adjusted to the brokenness and policies and systems that created what they're living with. That's a very important distinction, because how you seek to invest to bring about something different that can benefit everyone, because Bishop Miles is absolutely, absolutely correct. This is an economic conversation for this entire city, for this entire state. We can all benefit. We can all benefit, businesses, corporate, philanthropy, nonprofit. That we understand the genesis of this is really around structure.
A leader in the city pointed out, and I won't call the person's name, that what was most alarming to him about the Freddie Gray arrest was that as he was being taken to the vehicle to be put in, the number of adults in view of that camera in the middle of the day when adults should be at work. And that said to him that this is a city where too many people in too many neighborhoods do not have employment.
Mm-hmm. It was a Sunday morning, the day of his arrest, so I would just say that maybe not a day that people go by. But there are other, obviously other moments when you see that, when you see street corners with many adults in the middle of the day during the week,
and it's too frequent.
Traditional weekday, right. Work day.
And do we know that we have 100,000 adults in Baltimore that do not have a GED or a high school diploma? Of that 100,000, that over 13,000 are young adults from 18 to 20. Do we know that? Mm-hmm. Do we know that we don't have the resources for them?
Would you say, Bishop Miles and Diane, that people were in this group since April 25th, they were sort of shocked? I mean, the conversation obviously changed after April 27th. But would you say it went to a more of a shock level from the conversations you had been having prior to that?
I would say yes. I think that what April revealed was that much of what many of us in the group had been arguing and saying was reality became reality for people. That it was no longer just a discussion of theory and of history. It was the reality of what is Baltimore.
Yeah,
I will tell you, a number of my white colleagues who have gone through the training, who have gone, the organization may have even gone deep. We have paid for a number of nonprofits that actually do racial equity assessments of their entire organizations. So they shift their understanding, they shift their focus because they want better outcomes for the people they're serving. But they would share that they even found it challenging to have conversations with their white colleagues. They found it challenging to have conversations with members of their own family who didn't have the same set of lens, same set of knowledge that they had. And they were shocked about that perception.
Where do you think it goes from here then? I mean, you've provoked this conversation. I'm glad you did, actually, because we're having this discussion today. And Debbie Irving's going to be joining us with her perspective in a few minutes. But where do you hope it goes from here in Baltimore? Where do you see this conversation going, taking place?
Each group that's a part of the Baltimore Aspen Work Group are doing different things. So University of Baltimore, actually, is out of the Aspen effort, is actually developing a curriculum that are focusing on structural racism from a Baltimore perspective. And so we want to be able to use that. And certainly University of Baltimore will use that to expand the conversation and invite the corporate community in. Associated Black Charities has developed a racial equity policy lens at 13 questions to help policymakers look at the policies before they're developed.
To 13 ensure, questions to, yeah, to 13 ask yourself before questions. You put something into place?
Yes. Because if you think about the policy that was developed, as I talked about in terms of post-World War II housing, if you ask the question around, is this policy going to equally help both African-Americans and whites, although I'm not sure that would be a question then, but if you ask that question, do we have a measurement to look at the outcomes and how that helps African Americans, Latinos, whites, if you begin to ask yourself some questions and not make assumptions in your head, then you may have a different policy that comes out. That's important work. There are other groups. We're going deeper in community conversations. So there's a whole range that's happening with members of the group, and we as a group would like to figure out how do we deepen the education. We've been very disciplined not to do projects.
And Bishop Miles, before we go, what would be your message to someone listening today with regard to this? Might be a little skeptical. Some people, you know, tired of hearing about it. Those people, if you were to address them, what would you say to them about it?
I would say to them not to grow weary in hearing, but to get up and start doing. Because if we don't, as a community, pull together to resolve what's going on, then 3 years from now, we'll be right back at the table having the same discussion because there will be another upheaval that will take place somewhere else in the city. And I think what happens here in Baltimore should speak to the rest of this nation. If it just stays here in Baltimore, then we fail. Baltimore is not the only city in America that's going through what we're going through here. It's just that those cities have not reached the breaking point yet where there has been an explosion. But underneath the surface, all of the ingredients of an explosion are right there because they're going unaddressed.
It's the Reverend Douglas Miles, Bishop of Koinonia Baptist Church in Baltimore, and also with us in this segment of the show, Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities of Maryland. They are two among the many who signed this ad that appeared in The Sun and the Afro over the last few days, calling for real discussions about structural racism in Baltimore, part of the Baltimore Aspen Work Group. And you can find information about it at BaltimoreAspenWorkGroup.org. You can find it on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. We'll take a break here on Midday, folks. When we get back, Debbie Irving joining us to discuss her book, Waking Up White, which has been described as Racism 101. Community organizer, teacher, racial justice educator Debbie Irving joining us after this short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrick's here on WYPR, continuing our conversation this hour about race and racism. Well, could you be a racist without knowing it, even if you consider yourself to be a colorblind, well-intentioned white person who would never utter a bigoted word or harbor a prejudiced thought? Debbie Irving, that's one of the questions that she explored during a personal journey of discovery about race and racism and white privilege that she chronicles in a book that was published last year, Waking Up White. We asked Debbie Irving to join us for this conversation today on race. She's due in Baltimore this Friday for a speaking engagement at the Friends School, which is open to the public. I'll tell you about that a little bit later on. But first, I want to welcome Debbie Irving to our show here at WYPR. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, this is a very interesting book, very challenging book to read. Actually, each chapter of your book is sort of a guidebook for white people. And each chapter of your book ends with some questions or some exercises to perform.
Right. It started out as a memoir because I thought that would be what I would have responded to best if I were a white person who hadn't yet, what I call, woken up to the truth about how racism works in our country and how white people are involved in it. So I wanted a memoir, something an easy page-turner, easy to read, despite the fact that it's hard information. But I had a number of focus groups as I was writing it. The book that came out is number 10, and at one point a black man said to me, "You know, Debbie, I'm excited for white people to be voyeurs to your experience, but that's not enough. I need them to do their own work." And that's where the end of chapter question came from. And so now I call it a hybrid memoir self-help book.
Hybrid memoir self-help. Yeah, I would agree with that. But so tell our listeners at least this part. How old were you? Where were you in life when you decided to embark on this exploration, this sort of personal odyssey?
I was 48 years old, and I had spent 25 years on diversity committees, thinking I understood how this whole thing worked and what my role should be as a white person, and it turns out I had it all wrong.
What was wrong? What did you have wrong? You were an educator, a teacher, and you wanted to see more diversity in the institutions where you worked.
Yeah, I was such a good person. And I was so attached to the idea of being a good person, it would never have occurred to me that I could be doing more harm than good. But I was, because I was coming out of a mindset of helping and fixing people who, it turned out, I believed were inferior. And I would never have admitted that to you before waking up, because I really don't think I could have admitted it to myself. But the truth was, on a very deep level, I was racialized, meaning socialized with a racial perspective. I was racialized to believe that white people, in fact, were superior. That was the only thing I had to explain why white people were in all of the top government positions, living in the best houses, seeming to be the ones who complained the least. So that's how I made sense of it.
That's the world that we grew up in. That's how the world looked to most of us who were isolated from people of color. Did you have any experience growing up with people of color?
No. I lived in an affluent white suburb outside of Boston, and there was really no need to leave that white bubble. We had education, we had health care, we had commerce, we had whatever we needed. And then the outside world that came to me came in the form of 1960s and 70s TV shows, which were Leave It to Beaver, The Brady Bunch, Ozzie and Harriet. And so I really just was hammered with images of thriving white people. And then the only black people or other people of color were cartoons, maybe Mammy in Gone with the Wind. Just these fleeting and horrifically caricatured characters created by white people about people of color. So no, I had no real life understanding of who people were.
Well, what did you make of this? What did you make of white people, white police officers in the American South hosing down black men and women protesting on the streets or sicking German Shepherd dogs on them? What did you make of white people in robes that you might have seen, KKK robes in photographs in newspapers or on television?
So that's assuming I saw any of that, mm-hmm. which I didn't. Hmm. So in my household, my white parents thought that they were doing a great service to their kids by creating a kind of idyllic, protective childhood. And so we weren't even allowed to watch TV in my house, except when we watched Walt Disney together every Sunday night and The Wizard of Oz once a year, and every once in a while a public television show. We didn't even watch the evening news as a family. So I did not. The entire civil rights movement went mostly under my radar.
Okay, so we get to the year 2009. You're in middle age. You're going to Boston's Wheelock College to take some courses toward a master's degree, and you take a course called Racial and Cultural Identity.
Right.
What happened there, Deb?
Well, the first thing I'll tell you is I was excited to go because I thought that I was going to be learning about other races and other cultures so that I could be a better teacher to children of color.
Mm-hmm.
In the first class, the professor told us that this would be, one of the hardest things we ever did. It would be a deep dive into our own racial and cultural identities. And my thought was, well, what am I going to do? I didn't even know. I obviously knew I was white, but I had no idea what came with that and how it had shaped my perceptions and shaped my understanding of myself and my place in the world. And so I learned a lot of history, all that stuff I never saw on TV, and a whole lot more. And I came out of that class with my belief system pretty much in shambles and had to figure out what else don't I know. And how could I have been raised and educated in some of the best schools in this country? I was a history major. How could that have happened? And me been left to be so ignorant as an adult.
So your understanding of race then up to that point was that was something that belonged to other people, that experience occurred to people of color, maybe people in cities, people where there was more diversity than in your world. Your world, you didn't really race identify at all as a white person, right?
Exactly. And I thought racism was just when a white person didn't like a person of color or was bigoted. So Paula Deen was a racist and Ronald Sterling was a racist, but I couldn't be because I was nice and kind.
Well, there's a lot of people probably listening to this show right now who consider themselves the same way. They say, I don't have a bigoted bone in my body. If I utter a prejudiced statement, it's completely by accident, because I'm colorblind. I don't think this way. And
right.
So what do you say to people who challenge you like that?
I say, if I were doing a workshop, we would ask a lot of questions and we'd dig into the history that we don't know. But what I would say here is that what is so important to understand is the systems in play. So your last guests, by the way, that was great listening to the last minutes of that, were talking about the post-World War II housing era. You know, my dad was a GI in World War II. He was able to access the GI Bill. He went to Harvard Law School for free, and my parents bought a home in that suburb, Winchester, for $17,000. That was a GI Bill-backed loan. They sold that home 40 years later for $1 million, and you can imagine the additional wealth my parents accumulated through that free law degree with no loans to pay back. That GI Bill, which was connected to our housing, lending, and education systems, was not accessible to most of the 1 million black GIs. So when you think about that, you think about all my parents had to do to participate in one of the most racially imbalanced, egregious moments in United States history. All my parents had to do was take advantage of that, mm-hmm. without thinking about who was being left behind. All my father had to do was say, oh, I'm going to go get a law school degree. And yes, Winchester's a great place to raise our family. I don't know. They're not alive, so I can't ask them. Did you know when you moved to Winchester that black and brown people could not move there? And I don't know the answer to that, but that's an example of how you can be both. My parents were such good people. You can be a very good person, and yet as a white person in the United States of America, every day you're participating in racialized systems without even knowing it.
And in your parents' generation, even more so, abiding, you know, segregation, segregated covenants on where people could live and couldn't live, redlining, all those things. So, all right, so you abide those things, you live in that culture. What are you supposed to do about it? What are you supposed to do, rage against the machine? What are you supposed to do?
Well, I think, do you mean back then or now?
Let's go to now. Let's talk about now. So I'm with you on this, Debbie. I'm understanding where you are, and I'm just wondering, what are you supposed to do about it? Are you supposed to try to make friends with more black people, try to encourage more diversity at the place where you work, have discussions with people about race? What are you supposed to do with all this?
Well, I think we think about the fact that there's been a lot of legislation to create equity. So the most obvious being ending slavery and ending Jim Crow laws.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your last guest, Bishop Miles, I believe, was the one who was saying that if this isn't addressed, it will explode. It is simmering beneath the surface all the time. And despite the legislation, what has never been adequately addressed is the original belief system that this country was founded on. And it was founded on the belief that these white settlers, and, you know, my family was right in that mix. That's my heritage. These white settlers, their ways of doing things, their whatever they believed in the world, that's still the belief system that drives this country. And until we understand that this is a country built on a belief in white superiority, white Anglo male Christian heterosexual able-bodied superiority specifically, if we don't understand that, then all of the people who are marginalized by that mindset, that central value, all of those people, that simmering is going to erupt. And so I think what people need to do first and foremost is understand, learn, educate yourself. And the second thing is, I know that I needed to build a tolerance for listening to people who were angry and people who were struggling and suffering and simmering, because in my world, I didn't hear that. It was very easy to be nice and happy and optimistic. And so I lacked the opportunity to build a muscle to really hear from people who are living a different experience. And so educating ourselves and tolerating our own feelings of discomfort, when we start to learn about some of the ugly truths in this beautiful country, that's really the front line of action for white people right now, I believe.
I'm going to take a quick call here for Debbie Irving, because James called in along these lines to talk about American history and what we are taught, what we learn about it. James, go right ahead. Welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad you have that. Your guest is actually a teacher, because academics and education and learning about the true history of the contribution of African Americans in this country hasn't been expanded to teach all Americans the true contributions that African Americans have made in this country, and the history of Jim Crow, sundown laws, all those types of things. Those things aren't taught in academia. And you, it's interesting, you had Diane Bell McCoy, who was a member of the Board of School Commissioners, and she didn't emphasize the importance of educating our children, and not just black children, but all Americans, about the contributions that African Americans make. And I think that that's a major problem, because unfortunately it peels back that layer of the onion of American history that is not so pretty, and we have so many people in America who don't know the true African Americans' contributions, and African Americans can feel bad about themselves as children if they learn about the true contributions to America and the world, as a matter of fact, when you go back to Africa. So, and I've spoken to the school board about truly putting African American studies as part of the curriculum of social studies. Mm. And unfortunately, and as she stated, your guest stated, with predominantly white Anglo-Saxons, people who are on a school board, or blacks who are not enlightened enough to understand that true history affects everybody in different ways, but it needs to be exposed so that America can, since there's not going to be any reparations, there has to be, at a certain point in time, the realization that you have to tell the truth to everybody.
James, sorry, time is short here. I just wanted to say to Debbie, in response to what James saying and you're saying, I've heard many white people say, and you can call them racist if you want, but they say, I'm tired of hearing that. I know that history. Slavery's over. There's no excuse anymore for black people to feel that they're trapped in this system, that there's no opportunity for them. You know, I've heard this a number of times expressed by mostly white people who get impatient with this examination of history. That was then, this is now. Don't blame me for what happened in the 19th century.
Well, I would say they don't know the history that James, do I have his name
right?
Yes,
James, right.
Mm. Yeah, the history that James is talking about is crucial, because it's not talking more about slavery, more about Jim Crow. It's talking about those things, sure, but it's also talking about all the contributions, about the fact that the entire American economy that we live in today is built on the backs of free and also really cheap labor. And so, and you think there have been black inventors. There was this whole black Wall Street that existed at one point. So it's important to tell a much fuller history. And it isn't just a black-white issue. We don't talk about the indigenous experience of white Europeans coming to this country. We don't talk or teach children about Chinese laborers who came over here to build our railroad system, you know, at great peril to their own lives. And so there's a lot of history. You know, history is told by the winners. To say, I've had enough of this, let's move on. I think the only people who are saying, I've had enough of this, let's move on, are white people. And I think it's very, very hard. It was really hard for me to understand that what I was getting, constantly seeing myself reflected in curriculum, constantly seeing myself reflected in media images, that felt normal to me, but that is actually a privilege when other people aren't getting the same thing.
Debbie Irving is our guest. Debbie, we'll take a break here, come back and talk some more to close out the hour. Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator now and a writer. Her book that we're discussing is Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. I just want to say I was not aware of that announcement that you just heard about Debbie Irving's appearance at Friends School. We booked her for Midday independent of any knowledge about that. But I'm glad to hear that that we're spreading the word about Waking Up White and Debbie Irving appearing in Baltimore Friday, this Friday evening at 7:30 for a conversation at Friends School in the Upper School Choral Room. And there's information about that on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page as well. I picked a chapter out of Waking Up White to look at here. I thought this was interesting. It's the one called Boxes and Ladders, Getting in Touch with My Either-Or Thinking Habit About People. Either-Or Thinking. Let me just quote this, Debbie. You say, without awareness, I'm less likely to listen to or take seriously the ideas of a person I've been taught to see as less than, meaning less than me, less than white. I'm struck by how easily I can dismiss a suggestion or opinion of someone who's black or whose grammar is less than perfect, race and language being two critical cues I've used in my life to place someone in a presumed social location. I'm not an active snob, just a well-programmed passive one. Whether I sort and rank by age, race, ethnicity, class, religion, or some other difference, the either-or mindset puts me in a mode of judgment that obstructs my ability to learn and connect. Do you want to talk a little bit more about either-or thinking and stereotypes?
Yeah, wow. I haven't read that that passage for a while. Mm. Yeah, so the counter to either-or thinking is what's called both-and thinking. So actually a good way of thinking about it is, I think I'm a good person, therefore I can't be a racist. Well, in fact, it's possible to be both a good person and participating in a racialized system. So stereotypes, I was just hammered with so many interactions with white people, images of white people, that I was able to create huge nuance in terms of how I understand people who, as Ta-Nehisi Coates would say, believe they are white. So I know white people. When I meet white people, I also bring in, there's a class element. I take into account their age, what part of the country they grew up in, their personality. There's just so much dimension when I'm interacting with a white person. I don't see them as just a two-dimensional cardboard cutout white person. But for years and years, I did when I interacted with anybody who was not white. And part of it was this flood of stereotypes that I had stored away without even realizing it would start bubbling up to the surface. And we see this a lot, and I'm also guilty of this. Until I started to become aware, if I were walking down a street, I wouldn't think twice. A white person could walk right by me without me even taking note. But if a black person... if I crossed paths, I would be hyper alert to the fact that it was a black person. If it was a black man, I might very likely cross the street, change what shoulder my bag is on to make it further away from that person. They're just
I need to ask, is this all new to you, Debbie, since you took this class in 2009? Really, these are things you had not thought about growing up.
Well, there was the growing up, say the first 22 years of life, where I was really in a white bubble. I didn't think about any of this stuff.
And then after the
25 years, I thought about this stuff all the time, but I couldn't explain any of it. And I wouldn't have admitted, gosh, this strange thing happens when I'm talking to or I pass by a person of color. Like, my brain starts pumping all these bizarre ideas into my head. I tense up. I get nervous. I'm going to say something stupid. I wasn't sharing that with anyone because I thought it was just me, and I felt terrible about myself.
Let's take a couple of calls for you, Debbie, while we have you with us. Russ in East Baltimore has a question for you. Russ.
Greetings, Rod, to you and your guest.
Sure.
Very, very nice subject. My question I'll ask up front. What do you see as remedies, cures to some of these, whatever we want to call them, that has taken place in the past, to bring equity today? I want to ask that question because my family moved up to the 13th block of Lafayette Avenue, East Baltimore, 1951. We weren't Section 8. We weren't welfare. We had the required 10% down payment. The house was $5,200. We had the $550 down payment. But over the course of time, from 1951 to 1960, what happened because of the FHA program that was put in place that allowed whites to move into Herring Run, out St. Clair Lane, and so forth, with the 221 D2 program that required no down payments, closing costs rolled into
Russ, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're short of time. But you had a very specific question for Debbie, which is pretty helpful here toward the end of our time together, is a remedy for some of these. Now, do you mean problems that are still like that, or do you mean just today?
A remedy.
He's also got his radio turned up. I'm sorry about that. We want to ask Debbie, what do you see as a remedy for some of these problems? I guess, you know, where do you take it from here, Deb?
So I don't know Baltimore neighborhoods, but I certainly do know about the incident of Freddie Gray being mistreated to the point of death. Mm. And I would say so much of the remedy there is for white people need to stand up and demand justice. But it's very hard to demand justice when you really don't understand the injustice that you're living with. So I cannot say enough about learning about the situation. And I heard your, I think it was Diane Bell McCoy, was talking about having education about structural racism and having people understand the housing era. Learning why Freddie Gray's neighborhood is isolated in the same way my Winchester was isolated. Those are two ends of the same program. That neighborhood got the short end of the stick. My neighborhood got the long end of the stick, mm-hmm. in a single housing program that is still our racial housing footprint in the country.
And I think that was the point Russ was trying to make here. I'm sorry, we just short of time for that explanation. Housing policy is what the point he was making.
Yeah, and so housing policy, now you have a neighborhood that's that is saturated with black and brown, disenfranchised, castrated people, really, and you've got an over-policing mentality in there. And so for people to understand that it's not that black people are more criminal, it's that they're isolated in neighborhoods that get over-policed, there are higher arrest rates. I would run if I were a black person in America and a policeman were chasing me. So starting to understand all of these dynamics so that you get out of judgment. I also heard Diane Bell McCoy talk about how important it is, or maybe it was Bishop Miles, how important it is to get away from making assumptions and get curious, ask questions. Get curious. Why is this happening? Why is this happening again and again? Could it happen in my city? Who's telling me the story? What news channel am I watching? What do I and do I not have in my belief system? How many people of color do I have in my life that are close friends that are giving me their perspective? Start asking yourself questions and challenge yourself to become more educated and also to be brave and talk about it. White people are trained not to talk about it. People of color are trained not to talk about it. And when a person of color often offers up an insight, white people have been trained not to listen. And so I can't stop at conversation, but being able to use conversation as one of our many educational tools to understand what's happening is crucial.
Debbie Irving's book is Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. And Debbie Irving's book is published by Elephant Room Press. She's coming down to a visit here in Baltimore on Friday. That's this Friday, September 25th, 7:30 to 9 p.m. She'll be at the Friends School of Baltimore up on North Charles Street for a conversation about this. And some people who are, I guess, made uncomfortable or feel uncomfortable about this discussion, maybe you ought to go there and hear somebody who hadn't even thought about these things very much until figured them out until midlife, and now the result is this book, Waking Up White. Debbie, appreciate having this conversation with you, and enjoy your visit to Baltimore.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the first hour of Midday. We'll take a break for the news, and then the second hour of our show is Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell. We'll also take a break for some lunch provided today by Cipriarelli's in Little Italy. In business since 1940, Cipriarelli serves soup, salad, pizza, seafood, and pasta dishes. And boy, do they. Available for dine-in, carry-out, or catering, Cipriarelli's is on High Street, right there in the heart of Little Italy. So please stay tuned for the second hour of Midday.